Welcome to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cass. Thanks for joining us. Today is a little gloomy, but we've been having a beautiful spring so far. If you're part of the Legion who suffer from spring allergies, you may be rejoicing for the clouds because clouds bring rain and rain can tamp down the pollen. It's hard to enjoy mild temperatures and colorful flowers when you're wheezing, sneezing, and dripping at the nose. Spring can be miserable for those who suffer from seasonal allergies. And there are a lot of them. Hay fever affects at least 36 million Americans, according to the Food and Drug Administration. And studies show that number is on the rise, especially in industrialized countries. Climate change may be partly to blame. In some areas, the growing season has lengthened, extending the number of days plants like ragweed can produce pollen. Plus, carbon dioxide, one of the greenhouse gases that's helping to warm the planet, happens to be plant food. Increases in CO2 mean plants can produce even more pollen. All this is sobering news for those of us who already struggle to get through allergy season. What can we do to diminish the symptoms? Are there treatments we can start now to help us weather the pollen-heavy spring seasons ahead of us? Seasonal allergy expert Dr. Sandra Lin, associate professor in the Johns Hopkins Department of Otolaryngology, is here to help us answer those questions and more. Dr. Lin, welcome to Midday.
Thank you.
Before we get started, I want to invite listeners to call in with your questions. Are you raiding the Kleenex box more frequently this spring? Are you at your wit's end? Join our conversation. Ask your questions. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send us an email at midday@wypr.org. So, we read that more people are developing allergies or more people are showing allergies. Why would that be?
Well, we do see that industrialized countries over the past several decades, you're right, the allergic diseases, which are allergic rhinitis or nasal allergies and asthma, as well as skin allergies like eczema are increasing. And there's a lot of theories. It's very complicated, so there's probably not just one explanation. There is a hypothesis that came about around the late 80s, and it's called the hygiene hypothesis.
Hygiene.
Yeah. So
cleanliness.
So they were, wondering about that same question. Why is it that we're seeing more allergies in industrialized nations? So the people who came forth with this hypothesis said, there's something, if you're not exposed to germs when you're young or pets when you're young, there's something about shifting the way your immune system reacts more towards a more allergic profile. And, of course, this is just a hypothesis, but there is some data to actually support this.
What kind of data would support it?
Well, we see that people who are in farming, children of farmers and farmers themselves who have interaction with animals have a lower level than the general prevalence of having allergic problems. There have been some studies to show that children born into households with pets, domestic pets, cats and dogs, have less allergic problems. And some of the studies show that actually more than one animal is even better in that aspect. The data looking at exposure to viruses and bacteria is not quite as clear, because that was the other part. Is there something about exposures to viruses and bacteria? It's not as clear cut to support this hygiene hypothesis.
Well, back up for me. At the most basic level, what is an allergy?
So a person who is an allergic person has a overly robust immune response to something that the non-allergic person has no reaction to. So, for example, if you are allergic to cat dander, the allergic person, when they're exposed, it triggers an immunologic reaction. We call it a type 1 hypersensitivity reaction. And it's, the testing we do is specific for this type 1 reaction. And it causes, releases mediators from a person's own body, the primary one being histamine, that causes the end symptoms of sneezing, itching, runny nose.
And that's the body's attempt to get rid of this thing that has irritated.
They have an overreactive response, the allergic person. If you're not allergic, you know, you can be exposed to a cat and have no symptoms.
Right. But I mean, but the reason my body wants my eyes to water or wants me to sneeze is to get rid of this.
They're perceiving it as being dangerous to that allergic person. It's an overreactive response.
Mm-hmm. What is pollen? So, I mean, I know it's the yellow grunge
right.
that I see, like, on my car sometimes, but
so
when,
pollen,
what is it really chemically?
Pollen is, it's a protein that's released, if you remember back to biology class, and I can barely remember back to that, but it's the
stuff. Wait a minute, you're a doctor.
I'm
what
a doctor.
Do you mean you can
the
barely remember?
The plant biology is like, my kids are taking it. Kids are taking biology in high school. I think that's it's a pretty much of a stretch. But it's, you know, basically it's the stuff that helps plants reproduce. And if you think about it, pollen, to do its job, needs to fly around and be able to spread its seed. And so allergic pollens are those that we inhale. And there has to be some, not all pollen can cause allergies. But for pollens that really can cause allergies, they have to be small enough particles that can get blown around that we can inhale. And they have to be the right, you know, size that it would actually, you know, if it's too large, we're not going to be able to inhale it. So basically, pollen is that reproductive stuff from plants, and it's flying around in the air in the season where those plants are, you know, reproducing. For so right now is the tree pollen season, and in Maryland, we live in a beautiful state that has a lot of trees. But along with a lot of trees comes a lot of tree pollen. So I think that for patients who suffer from allergies in Maryland or the Mid-Atlantic, it's a particularly tough time.
Well, do we know why some people are more susceptible to allergies than others?
Well, I think that we know, what we do know is we're not sure why some people develop allergies and others don't. It's probably very complicated. When you look at, you know, the genetic and environmental factors that lead to developing allergies. But what we do know is that there is a genetic component. So that if both of your parents are allergic people, that it more than doubles your chances of being suffering, you know, being an allergic person and suffering from allergies. So we definitely know there's a genetic component or a hereditary component.
And do we has a gene been identified, or have genes been identified? Do we know who tends?
I don't think we know. Have you know? And this is not my area of expertise. I don't know about the genetic studies. I don't think it's been. It's probably going to be a several number of genes that are involved. So
do we see a difference among ethnicities in their proclivity to being allergic?
You know what? It's interesting that you bring that up. I do have noticed my personally that, you know, in some patients, but I see what I think are some trends. But it's interesting. I think the more the trends, when you look across like big worldwide studies, it's not necessarily by ethnicities. It's by degree of industrialization that you see different rates in being allergic.
And that ties back in,
to that hygiene hypothesis. And I'm sure there are studies of, you know, ethnicity and if you look at different countries, you know, I've certainly read articles when you look at different countries where they've done nationalized studies and these are the most prevalent. And they probably vary some by from country to country.
That is Dr. Sandra Lin here on Midday on WYPR. Dr. Lin is an otolaryngologist. I'm always mispronounce that. Would you pronounce it correctly?
It's otolaryngologist, or the common lay person likes to call us ear, nose, and throat.
Ear, nose, and throat doctor.
Yes.
At the Johns Hopkins University. You can be part of this conversation. Call us at 410-662-8780 or send an email to midday@wypr.org. Michael has called us from Baltimore. Michael, welcome to Midday.
Hello.
Hello, you're on the air.
Thank you. As a child and as a teenager, I suffered greatly from seasonal allergies. And as I've gotten older and now as a middle-aged man, I no longer suffer as severely as I did when I was younger. What is the reasoning behind that?
Well, thanks for your question. And what we do see is in a lot of patients this bimodal distribution of symptoms or lessening of symptoms As we go into adulthood, I'm not sure we really understand the reasoning why, but what we do see is that the onset of allergies is typically in a child or a young person. It's rare to see allergies develop in an elderly person. And we do see frequently that over time, the symptoms become less severe. And in addition, however, there's also another subset of patients where they have another uptick in symptoms as they get older. So beyond middle age and beyond. It's an interesting phenomenon. I'm not sure we understand why that is.
So Michael, we don't really have an answer as to why. I guess you should just give thanks that it happened to you.
You should be happy something good comes with aging, right?
Are people with seasonal allergies typically also allergic to other things?
So the last time, there's an answer for this, and I'm going to go into it. The National Healthcare Examination and Nutrition Examination, it's something the government does annually. And the last time they did one that involved allergy testing was in 2005. And they tested like close to 9,000 children and adults, and they were able to see what they were positive to. And about 20% of people had at least one positive test to inhaled allergens. And of those who were positive, 80% of them had more than one positive, and only 20% had one positive. So in summary, if you're allergic, your overwhelming chances are that you would demonstrate more than one positive on an allergy test. And very few people are only allergic to one thing.
And so the kind of change that Michael brought up of he grew out of his allergies, is it also then common to sort of shift emphasis and be more allergic to something and then grow to be perhaps less allergic to that but more allergic to something else?
I think some of it is also, environmental and what you're exposed to. You know, if you're living in an environment like in Maryland, we have a lot of tree exposure, and then you perhaps move somewhere else. Like I used to practice in the Midwest and the tree allergy season was less so. Or if you're living in, an environment where there's a lot of dust mites or molds in your home, you can see increases in your symptoms from the amount of environmental exposure that you're getting at that time.
Sean has called us from Cockeysville. Sean, welcome to Midday.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. So I had a quick question. My fiance works with a bunch of asthma-inducing things in her work, testing in like a laboratory aspect. And one of the things that she's mentioned a few times is the air of urban Baltimore, something that's used a lot in that vein. And I was wondering if you had seen any correlation between differences in like urban populations versus rural populations as far as what their response to allergies and things like that would be. And I'll take the answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks for calling, Sean.
So I guess when we look at climate change and pollution is another problem, and we do see that with pollution, it worsens the air quality. So for the caller's friend who worked in the lab, we do see worsening air quality makes it easier to have asthma. That's why they have those like alerts, like the pollution index. And, sometimes you'll say asthma sufferers, please stay inside. And there's also some theories that with pollution, and CO2, are we actually creating more allergens? There's been some studies when you look at carbon dioxide, which is a product of pollution, that in a laboratory setting, if you're growing ragweed and you increase the temperature, so that's perhaps global warming, and you expose to more CO2, the ragweed actually produces more pollen. So that's one theory, is that pollution, carbon dioxide, can be increasing pollen, and therefore you're exposed to more and you're having more allergic symptoms. There's also some thoughts that there may be interactions between some types of pollutants that make your normal barriers to allergy, it makes you more susceptible to expressing your allergic symptoms. And these are very theoretic. These are, we observe these changes. We don't always know how to explain them all. And there may be more than one explanation as to why, pollution increases allergy symptoms.
I'm not sure I fully understand the relation between allergies and asthma, and I'm going to ask you that when we come back from a quick break. Dr. Sandra Lin, an eye, ear, nose, and throat expert from Johns Hopkins, is with us for the hour. We're talking about allergies. You can be part of this conversation. Send us an email at midday@wypr.org or phone us at 410-662-8780. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. Hay fever, seasonal allergies, allergic rhinitis, call it what you will, it's no fun. We're talking causes, prevention, and treatment today with Johns Hopkins allergist Dr. Sandra Lin. You can be part of this conversation. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org, or you can phone us 410-662-8780. I haven't asked you yet. Well, let me follow up where we were right before the break. I'm not sure I get the connection between asthma and allergies.
So asthma, which is, you know, produces wheezing in patients and can, you know, problems with cough. When we look at patients with asthma, about half of them, 50 to 60%, have allergies and allergic triggers. So, for example, my son's got terrible cat allergies and he manifests. He doesn't have wheezing except for when we go over. We have a friend who has a particularly hairy cat, and that cat triggers his wheezing. So very frequently people with asthma have allergy triggers. It can be pet dander. It can be pollen, mold exposure, those types of things.
So bottom line, people with asthma seem to be more susceptible to allergies.
We know that there's this concept called the unified airway concept, and what we know is that it's basically the same type of lining tissue in your nose. It's going down your airway, and there is a very close correlation that if you have allergies, you're more likely than the general population to have asthma and vice versa. So there is a relationship.
I haven't asked you about treatments. Just as an entry point, what are the most effective treatments for seasonal allergies?
So we're really blessed in this day and age because a lot of very effective treatments have recently gone over the counter as far as medicines. But I guess we should back up a minute. And when we talk about treatment for allergies, as physicians, we talk about there's a three-pronged approach. One is what we call avoidance. So, you know, obviously, if you are allergic to cats, try and avoid going over to people's homes with cats. Or if you're dust mite allergic, there's things you can do around your home to decrease your dust mite exposure. Or if you're mold allergic, you know, I always tell patients, make sure you check for water damage, flooding you can't see, mold growing in hidden places. So one is avoidance. The next is medications. And a lot of the medications are, as I said, are really effective. Two of them recently went over the counter, nasal steroid sprays. So there is Nasacort and Flonase or Fluticasone. They recently went over the counter. It's the same thing your doctor used to write a prescription for, but now that the FDA has allowed you to actually purchase it without a prescription, then there's antihistamine pills. That are over-the-counter as well. Some really good ones like Zyrtec, Claritin, or Allegra are all available without prescriptions. Those are just some examples of the over-the-counter ones. And then there's some prescription medications. And then the final treatment we discuss is immunotherapy. And what immunotherapy is that we test a person, we know what they're allergic to, and we give them very small, controlled doses of what they're allergic to over several years to change the body's own immune response so it's not so hyperreactive. And what that translates into is decreased symptoms and decreased need for allergy medications.
So you just covered a group of chemicals, basically, medications that are aimed at controlling the symptoms.
Correct.
Of the watery eyes and the sneezing and the dripping. And then the last thing you talked about is actually trying to reduce the body's creation of these symptoms.
Correct. So one is treating the symptoms. The other is treating how your body responds so that hopefully it wouldn't even produce the symptoms. That makes sense.
So many people want to be part of this. Let me go to Steve, who's called us from Manchester. Steve, welcome to Midday. Steve?
Hello, yes, I can just barely hear you. I'm a beekeeper, and people often come to me for local honey, and they say it really helps with their allergies. Is there a scientific basis for that?
So thanks for asking that question, Steve, because I ran into this study. It was actually done in Indonesia, about 40 patients, and they took raw, unfiltered honey, and then they gave to the treatment group, and then they gave the control group fake honey, which was like, you know, colored corn syrup. So, and they found that there was an improvement in symptoms in the people who were taking the locally produced raw, unfiltered honey, and the dose that they were giving these patients was 1 gram per kilogram. So I calculated it out. That's 3 to 4 tablespoons for the average adult-sized person.
Oh, so, 1 gram per kilogram of their weight of that
right, of that person.
Weight.
And they, you know, we say the average male is 70 kilograms, but you know, so I mean, I figure that's about 3 to 4 or maybe 5 tablespoons of honey. And what they found
a day.
Okay. Well, a day. And they found it had a positive effect. And even after taking it for several weeks, if you stopped the honey, it seemed like the positive effects continued for 1 month. Now,
Steve wanted to know why would this be?
Yeah. So there's a couple of reasons why honey may be effective. One is honey has been shown in some studies to have immunosuppressive qualities. So it would tamp down on that immune response that allergic person is having. It has anti-inflammation properties. And then finally, it's thought that if you use the local honey with the local pollens and you're doing it every day, that you're doing local oral exposure to these allergens and almost like, you know, what we call a type of immunotherapy. Now, these are all still theoretic, because then I ran into another study done from the University of Connecticut, about the same size, but they gave people local honey, 1 tablespoon per day, versus, you know, national commercialized honey versus a placebo or fake looking honey. And they didn't see any changes. Now,
Amongst any of
the groups. So, I mean, I don't know if there's some difference in dosing. And these are, you know, these are very small studies. So in science, we, you know, really need to look for large studies, consistent direction of, you know, multiple studies saying the same thing. But I mean, but there may really be some effect, you know, for these patients that are coming and buying local honey from Steve.
Steve, I appreciate your calling us. Then that also raises the question of, in your experience, is there a placebo effect that's valuable? If people don't expect to be as miserable, does it turn out they're not as miserable?
Well, that's why it's very important to have the control arm who's getting the, you know, in this case, the fake honey, which is the brown-colored corn syrup or something. But what we do know in medicine in general, the placebo effect for anything, it can be very strong, up to 30%. For a placebo effect. So, I mean, there's something in that, in our mind and our expectations, you know, that can have some type of effect. But that's why it's important to always have this control group.
Heather has called us from Martinsburg with a question related to asthma. Heather, welcome to Midday.
Thank you. I work in a doctor's office in Martinsburg, West Virginia, and we see a lot of Medicaid patients. And Medicaid here will not pay for our allergy medications. And it just seems like our patients end up getting sinus infections, which leads to asthma problems. And I was wondering, in Maryland, will they pay for allergy medications? And if not, have you noticed the same kind of pattern where your patients get the sinus infections that lead to the asthma?
We're fortunate at this point for our patients on Medicaid, they do have coverage of some allergy medications, not all. So, I mean, it varies from state to state. I guess some of the other things that you can focus on if it's not covered in your state, maybe simple things. There's some studies that show nasal saline irrigations are helpful to control nasal allergies, and that's not very expensive. They sell kits over the counter to do nasal irrigations. And there's a lot of these medications that are available generic over the counter to patients. And I know that it can be difficult for some people in their financial circumstances to do that, and it's unfortunate that your state is not able to help these patients out.
Heather, I appreciate your calling. When we were talking a few minutes ago about immune therapy. I don't think we actually talked about the way it's delivered.
Mm-hmm.
Could you speak to that?
Sure. So immunotherapy, as I said, is delivering very small amounts of what people are allergic to over several years to change the immune response. In the United States, there are currently two types of immunotherapy in clinical use. One is, I'm sure most people have heard of, allergy shots. It's been done for decades in the United States. The typical way is the first year you go in, you go to a doctor's office, you get an injection. You need to wait 20 to 30 minutes after injection to make sure you haven't had an adverse event. And then you go every week, and then it starts spacing out over the years. And a typical course is for 3 to 5 years. So that's what we call injection immunotherapy. And then some newer developments here in the United States is sublingual immunotherapy. And there's actually two kinds of those. There's the sublingual immunotherapy tablets. These are made by, you know, large companies that make pharmaceuticals. And there's three tablets in the United States. One is for ragweed pollen. One is for tree pollen, and one was for ragweed pollen, one is for timothy grass pollen, and one is for mixed grass pollen. But they only treat those allergens, so there's only a small number of allergens we can treat with these tablets. Finally, there's sublingual drops, and what that is doctors here are taking what's approved for injection immunotherapy by the FDA, and they're using it what we call an off-label route. What off-label means is you're using a drug in a slightly different way than it was approved by the FDA. And we make we customize, just like the shots, what you're allergic to, and you dose them under the tongue typically every day, and that again is for 3 to 5 years.
So you basically put either the tablet or this other substance, mm-hmm. that's been made especially for your set,
exactly.
of allergies, and you hold that under your tongue and then eventually swallow it, or it
you can either swallow it or spit it out.
Well, Harvey has called us with a question about sublingual therapy. Harvey, welcome to Midday.
Yeah, I'd like to know why that under the tongue is not FDA approved.
I'm going to stall for a minute while Dr. Lynn pours herself a glass of water, which I should have put into her hands. She, as you heard Harvey just a minute ago, said that this use is off-label. But
so remember, the tablets are FDA approved. They are FDA approved. I think it was 2014. The drops aren't, because in the United States, when you want to get FDA approval, a company has to create the product and then put it through all the levels of different studies and then ask for FDA approval. And unless a company has a product and is willing to, it's a quite expensive process, you know, go through that process, we don't have any FDA approved products. And we don't. There are products in Europe that have been approved by their European, you know, whoever their governing bodies are. And actually in Europe, they've been doing sublingual immunotherapy for the drops since the late 1980s.
So what effect does that have on the availability of that kind of treatment here in the United States, the fact that it's an off-label use, it's not an approved use by the FDA?
So a lot of times I think it's confusing. The FDA off-label, we do, as physicians, probably do a ton of FDA off-label. That's not what affects availability. Right now, there's also no insurance code for mixing sublingual immunotherapy drops, and that's probably what affects it more so. The insurance will not cover it. And that's yet another really complicated process that someone has to initiate, creation of a code. It takes several years to do. So it's more that there's no code, and that's why most insurance companies will not cover it at this point.
Harvey, I appreciate your raising that point. Erica has called us from Baltimore. I think she wants to get back to one of the implications of the hygiene hypothesis. Erica, welcome to Midday.
Hi. I'm calling because my boyfriend, the father of my child, has extremely severe debilitating allergies. My baby is 7 months old, and I had read just about every study there is in the American Journal of Pediatrics about the formation of allergies, and read a lot about the hygiene hypothesis.
She's saying that basically babies need to be exposed to allergens during this time frame so that they don't develop allergies. My question is about the practical application of this in terms of hygiene. I want my baby to have a clean environment, but I also don't want to prevent her from coming into contact with the things that will help her develop a normal immune system. So what things should she be exposed to? What things should I worry about being overly sanitary about? You know, is it okay for her to sit on the ground, to like, you know, nom on my cell phone? You know, what sort of things should I be concerned about? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Erica, thank you for the question. Yeah, how can you harness the hygiene hypothesis to work for
well,
you
remember
when you're raising
kids. I want to emphasize, it's still the hygiene hypothesis. So we don't always have really clear cut. We don't have, you know, it's a hypothesis at this point. And so unless something is really clear cut, they don't usually have like clinical practice guidelines for something like this. I mean, I think you're just going to have to be, I have two kids. You're just going to have to be reasonable as a mother and, you know, what you think is okay is going to vary from person to person. There's obviously you don't want your kids to be in any dangerous situations, so where you might expose them to something dangerous. I guess I don't have really clear cut guidelines that I can quote. And
and in your observation of your patients, you haven't seen a pattern of parents who expose their kids to this or that have pretty good luck. And I realize that the plural of anecdote
is
not data.
No, it's not data. I mean, this is something you have to look – the hygiene hypothesis is something you look at in large populations. You know, so I guess that they do have some data with pet exposure. So, you know, that can be one thing you can expose to pets. I think if you're just reasonable, I mean, I think my kids, when they were growing up, we were chasing them all around, you know, at that time, the paranoia was always about like not letting your kid get sick. And so everyone's chasing everyone around with Purell all the time. And perhaps we overdid it. And, you know, letting your kids play outside is okay.
You mentioned that that your son has allergies to cat.
Yeah, but my one son has peanut allergy and both of them have allergies to cats.
But different allergies.
Different. Well, both of them are allergic to cats, and one of them has a peanut allergy. So maybe we Purelled them up too much. I don't know.
Well, we're going to take another quick break here. More time when we get back with Dr. Sandra Lin, an eye, ear, nose, and throat doctor from Johns Hopkins, taking your questions at 410-662-8780 or by email at midday@wypr.org. I'm Sheila Cast. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Midday, everybody. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking today about seasonal allergies with Johns Hopkins allergist and otolaryngologist Dr. Sandra Lin. And we're taking your calls. What's your experience this spring? Are you having a particularly bad allergy season? Have you noticed your allergies are better or worse depending on where you live? We'd love to hear from you. You can send us an email at midday@wypr.org or you can phone us at 410-662-8780. How did you decide on this specialty? What interested you about this work?
So, as an otolaryngologist, my area of specialty has been sinusitis. So, I primarily do nasal and sinus surgery. And there is a huge relationship between environmental allergies and sinusitis. And so I wanted to be able to take better care of my patients with sinus problems so that really the understanding of allergies really has been able to, when patients come in with nasal complaints, that I can look at them from, you know, not just the sinusitis perspective, but look to see if allergy is a component and vice versa. So it's really been I think really helped me provide the best care to my patients because, you know,
you're a surgeon. Are there times when surgery is the answer for someone who's suffering from seasonal allergies?
Well, that's an interesting question. So last year, I think the American Academy of Otolaryngology Head and Neck Surgery published some clinical practice guidelines on allergic rhinitis. And I'm saying that because patients who are interested in this topic, if you Google AAOHNS clinical practice guidelines, allergic rhinitis, they actually have patient materials. I think patients could find very useful because it talks about what over-the-counter medications might be, better for different treatments. But
I was asking whether
surgical treatment.
Surgery is the
yes,
answer.
Yes, and there's actually one of the clinical practice guidelines talks about surgery because one of the most difficult things to get rid of is nasal stuffiness from allergies. Like even with I have the subset of patients even with medications or even immunotherapy, they continue to have stuffy nose, and there's these structures in your nose that in allergic people get huge, so they block your breathing. They're called the inferior turbinates. And one of
they're called the what?
Inferior turbinates. If you ever really looked in your nose, you can see them protruding in your nose.
Okay.
Sometimes people think they're polyps incorrectly because you can actually see them if you look on the base of your nose in the mirror. And at one of the parts of the clinical practice guideline talks about the role of surgical therapy in allergic rhinitis. And one of the things that we did find evidence to support inferior turbinate reduction, a surgical procedure for those patients who have persistent stuffy nose and have not responded to other allergy treatment.
Hmm. I will get from you as soon as we're off air the link. We will link to the place where you said there are some good materials for patients. It sounded a little complex for people.
Okay, yeah, sorry about
to Google off the top. Carrie has called us from Dundalk with a question about the kind of pollen we have around here. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. I had heard on NPR a while ago that the trees that we're selling right now are somewhere between 70 and 90% male, and that's been going on since the 70s. Has there been any study about whether that the sale of male trees only has increased the amount of pollens in the air?
I'm not sure Dr. Lynn is an expert on the impact of the kind of trees we sell.
Nari, I don't know as much about plant reproductive systems as I, so I'm not really sure. But one of the things we have seen is that in the past 20 years that the tree pollen has an extra week. It's if you look over time, the tree pollen comes out earlier, probably due to climate change. So it has an extra week, so the season can be longer for people.
So it sort of can build up. Carrie, thank you for that call. We got an email from Andy who says, for years I've been taking pills and using nasal sprays year-round to treat allergies to cats, dust mites, grass, and pollen. Are there any negative effects to long-term use of these treatments? And I think John has a related question. Calling us from Frederick. John, welcome to Midday.
Yes, hi, and thank you for taking my call. I'm an adult in my 40s. I started getting spring allergies. I assume it's the tree pollen. I do live out in the country. But every year it seems like a new medication comes out, and the one that I used last year isn't effective the next year. Last year I started on the nasal spray Flonase, and that seemed to work pretty well for me. And I just have heard that if you alternate medications each year, that your system, I guess, doesn't build up immunity to it. Is that true, or do you have any comments about that?
We'll ask Dr. Lynn. So we have questions about long-term use of medications and alternating them.
I think one of the questions was about safety of long-term use. By and large, these medications have really good safety profiles, especially the nasal steroid sprays, like the ones that are now available over the counter. And what we call the second generation or non-sedating antihistamines have very good safety profiles. So they're approved down to very young age as far as the nasal sprays in children. So I think that they're very safe to use. And as far as does the effectiveness wear off? We haven't really been able to prove that the effectiveness wears off, but I do have patients who take antihistamine pills and tell me that, this is anecdotal, but I've had more than several patients tell me that this antihistamine stops working and they need to switch to a different one. I'm not sure of the mechanism. I don't know if it's just that their allergies in general are getting worse and it seems like the medications aren't working. I have not heard that with the nasal steroid spray. The other thing I want to tell the caller who says he has this spring pollen allergies is if you're going to use something like Flonase, I see a better effect if we get going on the medication a couple of weeks before the season even starts to start tamping down some of the response. So,
but not to use it year-round.
Well, okay, so we have to talk about year-round versus seasonal allergies, which I don't think we've talked about before. So some people are only going to have seasonal, you know, maybe just isolated tree pollen allergies, and that would, you know, their symptoms would be typically manifest like March to May. And then if that case, you know, you could do medications maybe starting in February and then finishing up at the end of May. But like, remember we said 4 out of 5 people have more than one allergy. And then the year-round, or what we call perennial allergens, that would be dust mites, molds, and if you live with a pet dander, those people if they have allergies that are affecting their quality of life year-round, need to be on some type of year-round treatment.
John, again, thanks for the call. The Baltimore Sun today has an article about alternatives to traditional alternative remedies that some people have turned to, and they describe one patient who takes a tincture, I think maybe under the tongue, as we were talking about, a solvent made of dried stinging nettles, peppermint, lemon balm, dandelion leaf, and red clover. I'm not asking you to endorse medicine that you don't believe in, but in a way it almost sounds as if perhaps they have picked up some of the elements that you would do in a more organized sublingual therapy.
Well, I am not an expert in herbal medicine, and so, but my understanding, I think for some of these things that I've read about, is that they have sometimes these herbs have anti-inflammatory effect as well. So maybe not so much desensitizing, but tamping down a person's immune response.
The response.
Yes.
So, and it's treating the symptoms, not necessarily the cause.
There is, you know, for that clinical practice guideline that I had mentioned earlier, we tried to look at the literature for herbal medicine. And what we try to produce is we call an evidence-based guideline. So we look at all the scientific evidence. And unfortunately for herbal medicine, a lot of it is written not in English. And, you know, in China, the traditional Chinese medicine's been going on for hundreds and thousands of years. And we felt that we couldn't make it a recommendation either way because we were unable to actually analyze the evidence because we can't. Unfortunately, we could not read Chinese the articles. So,
another alternative that the Sun writes about and I read about elsewhere, acupuncture. What's your opinion about that?
So yes, same thing in that clinic. We looked at the evidence for that clinical practice guideline, and there is good evidence to support acupuncture, particularly for those suffering from year-round allergies. So remember the dust mite, the mold, the pet dander. The evidence is not as strong for acupuncture for the seasonal allergies when we looked at the studies.
Huh. Willie has called us from Annapolis with a question for Dr. Sandra Lynn. Willie, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thank you. I, as an asthmatic, I also with plenty of allergies year-round. I get a monthly injection of a drug called Xolair, which I believe is an IgE inhibitor. And I wanted to ask, one, about your thoughts on the long-term safety of that. And two, wondering, since it seems to have not only gotten my asthma well under control, but it's done wonders for my allergies in general, if that will ever be prescribed just for people with allergies.
Thank you, Willie, for the question.
So right now, Xolair is not mainstream treatment for people with allergies. It's a drug that has to be given under close supervision so that your physician can monitor you with potential side effects or problems. But the reason it works, it's an anti-IgE medicine. So our bodies produce these immunoglobulins. We all do. And IgE is the immunoglobulin that is involved in the allergic cascade. Remember I told you the body's own immune response. So Xolair blocks that IgE, and that is why the caller is noticing an improvement in the allergy symptoms as well. So
Is that something that for him it was prescribed for? Well,
for
asthma, and he's asking, could it be just prescribed just for allergies? Would it be?
Would it be? I think it would have to be someone in pretty severe life-threatening allergies. So because of some of the issues of having to be under supervision, it can change some enzyme. You know, you can bump enzymes in your liver. You can have some serious reactions from this drug.
So it's pretty – what Dr. Lynn seems to be saying, Willie, is it's pretty heavy duty for allergies.
It's good. Yeah, that's why it is indicated for people with out-of-control asthma, though.
Willie, I appreciate the call. We had a caller Ray, who says he's allergic to perfumes, colognes, fragrances. Are there any medications to treat that?
So usually when people are talking about that, it's more of a chemical sensitivity and not – remember, I wouldn't hate to be so scientific and medical, but when we're talking about allergies, it is a type 1 IgE immunoglobulin mediated response. And the other ones, like the chemical, the perfumes and stuff, that's more of an, I think people should think of more as an irritant response, not the same immunologic mechanism. And really for those, avoidance is good. And if you're exposed to them on a chronic basis for whatever reason, nasal irrigation or washing might be helpful.
Yeah, we sort of flew past nasal irrigation earlier, and we have just a minute or so left, but is there something people should know about that?
There's been some studies, actually a couple of studies in children who have environmental allergies, and by doing a nasal flush with saline 2 to 3 times a day, it actually improved their symptoms. So, it's been proven to be effective. You have to really kind of get used to the sensation of flooding your nose with the saline, and you probably have to do it at least a couple of times a day. It helps physically wash out any of the pollens or whatever allergen particles in your nose, and it helps thin out the mucus. And
it has to be salt water, right?
They have commercial kits that you can buy, and you mix it with either distilled water or previously boiled, so therefore sanitized water, and you mix it up. And a lot of my patients do this every day, and they find great relief.
Because I saw a headline about brain-eating bacteria from
well tap water. Yes.
Okay, we're down to like a half minute. Do you have some words of advice to people who are out there suffering right now?
Well, yeah, my words of advice: if you are really suffering, please see a doctor who specializes in allergy. There's a lot of good literature, and we'll post that online.
We'll put that on the midday webpage.
Because there are a lot of really good medications, and I think this guideline will help you figure out what's best medically for you as far as the over-the-counter drugs.
I really want to appreciate your thank you for spending this hour.
It's been
hour,
more fun than
this.
I ever thought.
Dr. Sandra Lynn is associate professor in the Johns Hopkins Department of Otolaryngology. She's an ear, nose, and throat specialist and an allergist and a surgeon. And we're very grateful to you. I also want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch for our guest today. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features unique sandwiches and salads with specials each day, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. And thank you for listening. Hope you'll be back with us tomorrow. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned now for Here and Now, and have a great afternoon.
Midday is produced by Maureen Harvey and Andrea Appleton. The show is engineered by Luke Spicknall. Music produced by Jeff Truman and High Gravity Sounds. Midday podcasts and live streaming are available at WYPR.org or on demand using the WYPR app. This is WYPR, your NPR news station.